Powerful words, powerful words. Good morning, church. It's good to see y'all. Good to be together with you as always. I'm so thankful that we have a congregation where we have so many great dads we can celebrate on Father's Day. So it's very different than Mother's Day. With Mother's Day, we always have our big our baby dedication. And with Father's Day, traditionally we've done weed eaters and lawn mowers, but I'm glad that we didn't even have to do that this year to bless those. No, it's good. We were talking about that this morning in our elders meeting, how thankful we are for so many great men and dads and examples that we have in our congregation. Such a blessing. And since Zach brought it up, I guess I'll mention it too. I had a great big race recently, and I saw Zach back there, and he looked like he was struggling a little bit, but I didn't want to discourage him, so I just kind of kept going. Anyway. All right. Imagine that you've been looking for a house. Some of you have been through this. I mean, this is not pretend for some of you, but imagine you've been looking for a house for a while, months even. And you go through house after house after house, and they're all just not right. Some of them are falling down, they're in bad neighborhoods, or they don't look right, or the layout is built meant for really tiny people, or just, I mean, hypothetically. You've worn your realtor out to the point that they're no longer working for commission, they're working on spite. And finally, you find it. I mean, it is the house. It is in your price range. It's just come on the market. You are the first one to kind of pounce on it. The landscaping is immaculate. And the lawn looks like a golf course. I mean, it's beautiful. The kitchen counters are just spotless. And you can just already picture your family living in this beautiful, beautiful home. Everything about this house says, this is the one. And then comes the home inspection. And that guy shows up and he crawls up into the attic and he gets down and he climbs through the crawl space, right? And he checks out all the stuff that you don't see, and he checks all the stuff that you didn't even think existed, right? Even things you never even thought to examine. A few days later, the report arrives from your home inspection, and man, there are foundation issues, and there's water damage that you didn't know about. There's mold hidden in the walls, black mold, right? There are structural problems from something that the original builders did. There's active termite damage going on. It turns out the wiring is faulty, and that's going to have to be replaced. But man, it still looks so beautiful, right? You can still imagine your kids playing in that front yard. You can still picture your family in that great room with the big picture window. You're still imagining the great Super Bowl party buffet that would be laid out on that kitchen island, right? So what do you do? Well, in Genesis 13, we get to see two men who are looking at the same world, one who chooses by what he sees, sight, and the other one who chooses on faith. Now, I'm going to tell you up front, especially if you've heard this story before, the story of Abram and Lot. Those of us in this room, we need to listen to this. This is important not just for knowing the story of the Bible, but we need to get the point of this lesson that God is making here. All of this is going to sound, as we go through it, it's all going to sound very theoretical, but it very much applies to you and me, and I'm going to explain how at the end, but we've kind of got to get through the story first. So the chapter starts out, this is Genesis chapter 13, chapter starts out, Abram and his family, they leave Egypt. Now last week, if you were here, you know that they went down to Egypt because there was a famine in the land, and he headed down to Egypt, he got in a lot of trouble, he lied about some stuff, but now God has rescued him out of that. They leave Egypt. They head back up to where they were supposed to have been all along, the place God had showed him. And they get there, and things start going well. In fact, they're going really well. They're going so well, in fact, they've been blessed so much that the land that they are living in can no longer support everybody. All of the large herds and the flocks and the tents, there's just not enough there for everybody. And that leads to a couple of different groups of herdsmen, Abram's herdsmen and his nephew Lot's herdsmen. They get into fighting over, you know, grazing pastures, and you imagine water rights or whatever. But the main thing is that they just couldn't all live in one place anymore. The land wouldn't support it. There's also some other people who are living there. There's just not enough land to go around. So Abram goes to his nephew Lot, and he says, look, there's plenty of land out here. Let's just split up. So you pick whichever way you want to go. I'm just going to let you pick whichever way you want to go, and then I'll just go the opposite of the way you go. And so now Lot has to choose, where is he going to live? Where's he going to take his part of the family? Where are they going to live? And this is what we're told in Genesis 13, beginning at verse 10. Lot looked around, and he saw that the whole plain of the Jordan toward Zoar was well watered, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan and set out toward the east. The two men parted company. Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tents near Sodom. Now the people of Sodom were wicked and were sinning greatly against the Lord. So let's pause right here. And first, let's just notice what Lot sees. Notice what Lot notices. He looks out and he says, one, there is fertile land, right? There is seems to be abundant water. And that means economic opportunity, and that means future prosperity. That's what he sees. When he looks out and he says the plain of the Jordan, think valley, like a river valley. It's large, it's flat down there, plenty of irrigation from the river. So he looks out and he sees it this way, and it's so great that the writer of Genesis describes it as the garden of the Lord, which should really catch our attention as we've been going here through here. Lot sees something that to him looks like paradise. It reminds us of the Garden of Eden, right? That's what we're supposed to be reminded of. And from a purely practical perspective, his choice, Lot's choice, makes perfect sense. If you and I were standing up here on this hill looking out into the Jordan Valley and we saw what he saw, it would be completely understandable. If Lot were standing beside us and he made that choice, none of us would have said, what are you, crazy? We wouldn't have faulted his logic for choosing a better, more fertile place to live. When you're making a living by agriculture, of course you're going to choose the better land, right? We often do the same thing, as a matter of fact. We're trying to make life decisions and we're like, well, which job pays more, right? Which house is in a better school district? Which neighborhood is nicer? Which gives me more opportunity to advance my goals? Which choice makes life easier? Now, by the way, none of these are bad questions. Just like it wasn't wrong for Lot to notice green grass and plenty of water, right? None of these are bad questions. They're just incomplete. In the same way Lot's observations were incomplete. Notice that after Lot makes his choice, the text quickly adds, oh, and by the way, the people that lived there were super wicked, right? Lot makes his choice because of the green grass and plenty of water, great place to raise your herds and raise a family, and oh, by the way, lots of bad people there. So Lot sees the green valley. He imagines his family sort of setting up shop there, pictures them prospering. The problem isn't what Lot saw. The problem is what Lot didn't see. And what Lot didn't see was Sodom. He did not notice the wickedness. Now, maybe he did see the city. To be fair, maybe he knew the city was there, but he doesn't think it'll be a problem. We don't know. Scripture doesn't tell us. The main thing that we do get is that Lot, whether he knows about it or he doesn't know about it, he overlooks it. He doesn't factor in Sodom's wickedness when he's making his choice. And there will be consequences that we're going to learn about down the road. Lots and lots of consequences that we're going to learn in some future lessons. But in the meantime, we got to go back to Abram. We're going to head back up on that hill. And if you think about it, Abram's response to the overcrowding problem that they have where they're living, Abram's response was pretty remarkable, wasn't it? Abram is the older man. He's kind of the patriarch. He's the one who gets to make the decisions. So he's the one who's received God's promise. He's the one who's led them to this place. He had every right to choose. But Abram doesn't do that. Instead, he tells Lot, I'm not going to choose, you choose. Which is pretty amazing. Why would he do that? Why wouldn't Abram just say, look, I'm going to go over here, you go somewhere else? Instead, he says, Lot, you choose, and I'll go whichever way you don't. And again, the text doesn't explicitly tell us why Abram kind of went this route, but his actions and God's response seem to be telling us it was because of Abram's confidence was not in the land. In other words, the land didn't matter to Abram. Abram's confidence was not in the land. Abram's confidence was in God. Abram believed in God's promises so much that Lot's choice couldn't mess it up. Does that make sense? He believed that his future was not going to be determined by how much grass he had access to, how much water was going to be there. His future is not determined by those things. His future was determined by God. Lot believes, I need the best land. Abram believes, I need God's blessing. And those are two very different things. Here's the amazing thing about God's promises, church. This is important, so I want you to listen to this. The amazing thing about God's promises is that no one can steal them from you. Everything you have can be taken. Sometimes you've experienced that. Some of you have experienced that. Your possessions, they can be stolen. Man, I've had a car stolen. I've had the same car stolen again. I've had other stuff stolen. Bicycle, lawnmower. You know, we've had stuff stolen. Your home can be taken away from you. I've had friends who lost their job and not able to keep up house payments. Their home was taken away from them. Your health can be taken away from you. I mean, look healthy as a horse, and the next moment you go in for a regular checkup and you find out, oh no, something's really wrong. And very quickly, you can lose your health. Your family can be taken from you. Everything you have can be taken away from you, except for God's promises. They are secure in a way that nothing else is. Think about it. They are so solid that everything in your life can fall apart and you can still have God's promises. So faith like this, faith like Abram's, gives us this amazing opportunity because we're always going to have God's promises, so we don't have to hang on to everything else like with a death grip, which is what our world generally says. That if you've got it, you better fight for it and you better hang on to it because nobody's going to give you nothing and you got to take it and have it and keep it. Whether it's power or money or possessions, whatever it is, you've got to grab it and hang on to it. And what Abram says is, no, the land doesn't matter. I just need God. Because God's promises are sure. So I can let go of the land, let go of the green grass, let go of this lush valley with water and all that. Brothers and sisters, we don't need, this is very freeing. It ought to be very freeing. We don't need all the stuff that we hoard to take care of us. We need God. And if we have God, the rest of it will kind of work out. But we don't need all that stuff. And that's what Abram's actions seem to be reflecting as well, this deep trust and dependence on God. And this is how, when Abram has that kind of faith in God, this is how God responds. So the Lord said to Abram after Lot had parted from him, look, Lot leaves. I've seen what you've done here, Abram. This is what the Lord says to him. Look around from where you are, to the north and the south, to the east and the west. All the land that you see, I'm going to give you and your offspring forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone could count the dust, then your offspring can be counted. That's a strange way of phrasing it, but basically saying you're going to have more descendants than there is dust on the earth. You're just going to be uncountable. There's going to be so many of you. So he says, go, walk through the length and breadth of the land, for I am giving it to you. So after Lot leaves, Abram has opened his grip, right? I'm not hanging on to the best land. I don't have to have that. And after he does that, and he says, he's kind of in essence saying, whatever you want, God. After that, God shows up to reaffirm his promises. And he tells Abram, look around. You remember that phrase earlier? Lot looked around. Now Abram looks around. Not a coincidence. They both look around, generally in the same area. They're both looking around the same area, but Abram and Lot see two very different things. They're looking at the same stuff, and they're seeing two very different things. Lot saw the green pastures of prosperity and immediate gain. Abram sees God's promises. He saw his inheritance. He saw the future God had planned out for him. To be more specific, Lot sees a valley. Abram sees a kingdom. Lot sees today, what I can get today. Abram sees generations down the road. Lot sees what is clear and visible and obvious. And Abram sees what is actually true. That's the difference. They both stood in virtually the same place. They both looked around, and they both saw two different things. Again, if you and I were standing there in person watching all this unfold between Abram and Lot, we would think Lot came out the winner. Lot gets the better land. He gets the greener valley. He gets the greater opportunity. But Genesis is teaching us something very important right here. It is a deeper truth that what you can see isn't nearly as important as what you believe. What you have isn't nearly important as what you believe. Centuries later, large groups of people are going to come out and see this teacher in Galilee. Now, some of them are going to see this really uneducated guy who is deceiving the more uneducated masses. They're going to see someone who is dangerous and threatening, someone who's sent by and empowered by Satan himself. Other people who are there at the same time looking at the same guy. They're watching the same stuff happen. They were in the same place, right? They are going to see him, and they're going to see redemption and love and forgiveness and hope and life. Because what you believe determines what you see. You and me and all of us could see the exact same thing happening, but what we believe will interpret what we see. The same way it did for Abram and Lot. The same it did for the crowds of people who came to see Jesus. If you believe one way, you're going to see Jesus one way. If you believe another way, you're going to see Jesus another way. But there's only one right way. Right? What we believe is determines what we're going to see. The greatest act of God in history, the greatest thing God did in the history of the world, looked like defeat to everyone who was standing there. Because what we believe determines what we see. To see it as a victory, we've got to look at it through the eyes of faith, because it doesn't make any sense otherwise, right? So, here we are this morning. We're sitting here, and you're like, okay, we're in church, we're talking about Jesus and how he won the victory on the cross. That's pretty easy. I'm on board, preacher. I am on board with that. But it is awfully difficult. And I'm telling you it's awfully difficult because it's awfully difficult for me, and I'd like to think I'm not the worst one here. But it is awfully difficult where the rubber meets the road. When you're standing at a point of decision in your life, and there's the easy way and there's God's way, that is hard. Right? Now, I'm not just talking about the right and left decisions. We all make right and left decisions. What job am I going to take? What car am I going to drive? What house am I going to buy? What outfit am I going to wear to church? What am I going to buy my dad for Father's Day? All very important questions. But they're all right and left questions. And God may give you some direction on that. I don't know. I'm not concerned about that this morning. I am concerned about the right and wrong decisions. The places where God has explicitly given us his will, and we still have to choose the harder path instead of the path that makes more sense. Now, do you know what I'm talking about? Let's get some examples. You can get out of paying a bill or paying your taxes, and it's not honest, but no one's going to know. And no one's going to find out about it. You're not going to get in trouble, and you're not going to get caught. Now, what do you do? There's the easy way, and there's God's way. So which path do you take? God has something to say about honesty. But man, nobody's going to know. If you can get out of a jam with a little white lie, and it's going to make everything better, and everyone's going to be happier, and no one's going to know but you and God. Again, which path do you take? You're at a fork in the road. Are you going to go down to the valley, take the easy path, or are you going to take the hard path, right? We all have these scenarios. There's a million of them. Every moral decision we have, we can come up with reasons for doing it the way we want to do it. Am I right? All these little scenarios. I'll give you some of the more popular ones. It's not going to hurt anyone. No one's going to know. God is going to forgive me. It's only this one time. Just raise your hand when I get to your favorite. Right? I mean, I could do that all day long. We have these ways of convincing ourselves that we know what's better than God. That what I think is more important than what God promises. So here we are, we're standing like Lot, we're standing on top of that hill, right? We're overlooking the Jordan Valley, and we're convincing ourselves it's all going to be fine. That I can just do this one thing, or I can just think this one way, or I can talk this one way, or I can trust in this one sure thing, and it's all going to work out just fine. It's really not that bad. But brothers and sisters, if we want to claim the promises of God, we have to believe that those promises are important. We have to not just say we believe those promises when we come to church on Sunday. We have to live by those promises. We have to act on those promises. We have to say that those promises are more important than the house I live in and the car I drive and the place I work and the family I have. That God's promises are the most important and the most sure thing in my life. And when we do that, it shapes us. It changes us. It makes us into crazy looking but amazing moms and dads. It makes us into people who change workplaces. Change communities, shape generations, of the children to come after us. And that is my prayer for you, my prayer for us. Not that we're always going to get it right, but that we'll stop taking the easy way and we'll start trusting God's promises, even when it's the hard way. So if we can pray for you, encourage you, forgiveness, strength, encouragement, ready to become a child of God, have your sins washed away, and start a new life. If we can help you this morning, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?